Good to see you out. As Steve mentioned, we're so excited to see Brother Hayes out. We thank Stephen for bringing him over. Now, that's not necessarily convenient, and we appreciate it. We're glad to see you out. We've been praying for you, and we continue to pray for you that things go well for you and that you continue to heal and get better. I feel like I should apologize that you don't get to hear Tim. His daughter is, of course, in the Lipscomb Chorus, and they are visiting, I'm not sure which congregation it is tonight, but he is with them and able to hear them, and we're excited that he has that opportunity. We know what it's like when our kids get involved in these kinds of things, and we're excited that he can go and be with her. So you're left with me, but we'll get through this together. In June of 2020, the Houston Association of Realtors decided that they would no longer use the word master when they were describing the largest bedroom or bathroom in a house, either in their online descriptions or when they were showing the house in person. Apparently, they had been debating this for some time, but they came to the conclusion, as we remember what went on then, that the racist and sexist overtones of that term were strong enough that they just wanted to avoid the issue, and so as an official group, they decided they would use the word primary instead. And several other associations of realtors followed suit. And it made the news, and we heard about it, and so I'm telling you about it. Now, maybe you're like me. I'm tempted to kind of judgmentally dismiss that as an overreaction to people who are too sensitive and are seeking reasons to take offense, because that's not the way that word is being used, and there's no reason to take offense at that and all of that. But even as early as 1995, Housing and Urban Development is what HUD stands for. I can't remember the name of the government organization. But at any rate, they issued a statement saying that the use of the term master bedroom does not constitute a violation of either the sex discrimination provisions or the racial discrimination provisions of the Fair Housing Act. So it had been an issue that long ago, something I had no idea about until I went and looked it up. So, again, I have a tendency to kind of dismiss that and think, oh, that's crazy, that's silly, that's ridiculous, why would they do that? Instead, perhaps I need to take that as a reminder that words mean things and that words have connotations, those shades of meaning or that baggage that comes with the word, and it strikes different people differently. And so I need to be careful and think about what I say and how I speak and not seek to give offense. We're going to follow Jesus' example. It's certainly true that he didn't tiptoe around people when he spoke. And there were people that were offended by what he said, but it was because he spoke the truth. He didn't change what he said, but he also didn't seek out ways to offend them, and he didn't judge them based on the meaning they attached to certain words. So instead of judgmentally dismissing it, perhaps I should do a better job of thinking about what I had to say. Now, I don't bring this up just to confess that I am tempted to be judgmental. I bring it up to simply emphasize the point that even in today's culture, 157 years after the practice of owning another human being was outlawed in this country, this whole concept of slavery still makes people uncomfortable. Even the word master, the word slave, these are words that are used in particular ways. In mechanics and cars, we talk about a master cylinder in your brake system. This is the first cylinder as a part of it, and it's the one that pushes the hydraulic fluid out to the slave cylinders that actually squeeze the brakes. And that's more than you wanted to know about a brake system. But we have master-slave relationships in computers. We have servers that are masters, and we have slave computers, but all of that terminology is going away because this concept of slavery is so provocative in our society. Now, whether that's good or bad is a topic for another time. I just find it interesting that we so focus on that, that we find offense at the very idea that a person would take someone else's freedom away. And we generally interpret that freedom as the ability of someone to make their own decisions, to determine their own lives, what they're going to do and what they're going to say and how they're going to do things. And if somebody is going to perform an action for someone else, then they should be compensated for it, right? That's the thrust of our society today. And there are certainly good points to that. But in Romans chapter 6, Paul makes it very clear that we all serve a master. In verse 16, he says, "Do you not know that you who present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one's slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness?" In other words, we all have a master. We're serving a master. And if we're not being obedient to God's will and God's word, then sin is that master. It is one of the two. Now, we put that in modern terms, and somebody might object, saying, "I don't have any master. I make my own decisions. I decide what I'm going to do. And if I want to go here, I go here. And if I want to go there, I go there. And if I want to do this or say that, that's up to me. Nobody tells me what to do." But what Paul is saying there is that if we're not following God, if we're not serving righteousness, then we are serving Satan. That person who might object in that way is simply serving Satan by putting themselves on the throne. Now, we're familiar with that. We understand that. Jeremiah was inspired to write in chapter 10 and verse 23, "O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps." This morning in class, we talked about Judges chapters 19, 20, and 21. And we saw just how things go when every man does what is right in his own eyes. And we saw the horrible situation that people find themselves in. And as I was talking to Charlie after class, it just seems to get worse and worse and worse the further you go. That's the situation that the world found itself in before the flood. God looked down and he saw that every thought of their hearts was only evil entirely. That's what happens when everyone tries to direct their own steps. When everyone decides for themselves what they're going to do, when everyone is free to make their own decisions, and everyone is serving themselves, is serving Satan by putting themselves on that throne. The good news, however, is the gospel is that we have a choice. It's that we can choose which master we want to serve, whether we want to serve ourselves, whether we want to serve Satan, or whether we want to serve God and lead a life of righteousness that leads away from eternal death and toward eternal life. In John chapter 8, Jesus said, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Now he's talking to the Pharisees there, and they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" And it's funny, because I looked in commentaries, I was trying to figure out if there was something in that that wasn't necessarily immediately evident, and the only commentaries I could find on it were basically, that's a very strange statement for them to make. Because at this point in time, when this conversation is taking place, Rome rules over the Jews. And you look back at their history, as we've done through the book of Judges and throughout the rest of the Old Testament, all time after time, we see them under foreign rule. So how could the Pharisees say, "We've never been in bondage to anyone"? I don't know if they were kind of caught up in the argument and weren't really thinking through what they were saying, or if perhaps they were echoing that modern sentiment when they said, "We don't have a master," and they're saying, "We make our own decisions. I'm in charge of my own life." Jesus told them, Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." When we're faced with that choice, we can choose to put ourselves on the throne to do what we want to do, or to serve God and live a life of righteousness that leads to eternal life, the Son can make us truly free. As Paul continued in Romans chapter 6, "But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness." We have, through the gospel, the option to be set free from the sin that can enslave us. What a wonderful blessing that is. I don't know what goes through your mind when you think about someone being enslaved to sin. As I kind of picture that phrase and the images that come to mind, I might think of someone in a jail cell serving a life sentence for crimes they've committed. They've been enslaved by that sin. Or I might think of somebody in the throes of addiction, living on the streets in squalor, having given up everything they had in pursuit of the next high. Now you might think of the high-powered politician who is under the control of his high-dollar donors. He can't do what he thinks is right because he's got to make sure that they make the next payment so that he can get reelected. Or maybe you think of that famous entertainer that's living a kind of double life to keep some hidden secret. And all of those are examples of people who have been enslaved to sin. But isn't it interesting that unless you're going through something personal, you very rarely put yourself in that place. And I'm certainly not suggesting that you necessarily should. But I want to contemplate that for a little bit tonight. I want to think about the possibility that we can be slaves to sin. You see, one of the most dangerous phrases that we can hear ourselves say from time to time is, "That's just the way I am." Someone might approach us about a comment they overheard or saw on social media or read in an email or something, and they come and they say, "You know, I saw you said that was kind of, I'm not sure that was the right thing to say." And we think, "Yeah, well, that's just the way I am." Now, you've heard people say that. Maybe you've used it yourself. I personally am challenged often to be more outgoing, to be more social, to approach people and talk to people, get to know people. But I have a tendency to say that's hard for me, that's not who I am. We let opportunities to talk about Jesus with others go by because I can't do that. That's not how I'm wired. Whether we're making an excuse for something we said or something we didn't do, when we say that's just the way I am, that's an appeal to our nature, to what does or does not come natural to us. Sometimes we even acknowledge that we know better. I know I shouldn't do this or say that, but that's just the way I am. The great news is it doesn't have to be the way we are. Jesus can help us change. Let's go to Exodus chapter 3. I want to look at Moses as an example of somebody who didn't allow the way they were to control them. Now, at this point in Moses' life, he's grown up in Egypt, had the best of everything the strongest country in the world at that time had to offer. He grew up in the palace, basically as a grandson of the Pharaoh. But he's identified with his people, and at one point he saw an Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite, and he takes that matter into his own hands, ends up killing the Egyptian taskmaster, buries him in the sand. And later he sees two Israelites fighting. He goes and he says, "Why are you fighting with each other?" And they say to him in their anger, "What, are you going to kill us like you did the taskmaster?" And then he knows that it is known, that it's not hidden. So he leaves. He goes to the land of Midian. And at this point, he's kind of made a life for himself. He's taken a wife. He has a son. And he's out tending the flocks of his father-in-law. And you think about being in that situation, and I'm sure he felt like he was pretty comfortable. He's probably looking out and saying, "You know, I'm probably going to inherit these flocks and this land and this place, and I've been able to find a life for myself. Even though it's not the palace, things are going pretty well for me." But one day he looks out along the horizon and he sees something, and he sees a bright spot, and he thinks, is that fire? That's not good. I don't want the pasture to catch fire. Then the flocks couldn't eat, so I need to go check it out. I'm going to go look at it. But it doesn't seem to be spreading, so maybe it'll be okay once that bush burns up. Then it'll all kind of die out right there and won't be a problem. I wonder how long he waited before he noticed. I wonder how long I would take to notice that the bush isn't burning out. It's not burning up. But as he comes close, he hears the voice of God himself say, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near to this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Can you put yourself there? He's in the presence of the God who created the universe. There's no wonder he's afraid. But he doesn't even at this point want to look at the bush. But God continues to tell him about the oppression of his people here in Egypt. And God says, I have chosen you to go back to Egypt and to lead the people out. Verse 11, Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring out the children of Israel out of Egypt? Moses is pretty comfortable where he is, and he's not sure that he's the right person for this job. He's not sure this is who he is. God responds that he's going to be with him and promises Moses that when they come out, they're going to worship him on that very spot. Moses isn't quite convinced. So he says, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. He said, thus shall you say to the children of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. And God goes on to detail the miraculous acts that he's going to perform in the land of Egypt to bring his people out and to take them to the land of Canaan and give them the land that he promised to Abraham. In chapter 4, verse 1, then Moses answered and said, but suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. So God gives him the signs of the rod turning into a snake and back into a rod, of his hand becoming leprous and then becoming whole again, and of the water becoming blood on the dry land. In verse 10 of chapter 4, then Moses said to the Lord, oh my Lord, I'm not eloquent. Neither before nor since you've spoken to your servant, but I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. This is the man who's going to be the giver of the law. This is the man who's going to lead the people through the Red Sea. This is the man who's going to climb Mount Sinai and witness the glory of God. And when he comes down from the mountain, just the reflected glory of his face is going to scare the Israelite people when they see him. This is the man who's going to intercede with God and basically help God deal with the people of Israel. And yet at this point, he's still worried about who he is. I can't do this, Lord. I can't speak well. That's not who I am. Don't you understand, God? Finally, in verse 13, after God answers each and every objection, we come to the crux of the matter. But he said, oh my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Moses didn't want to go. He's scared. But God answers every single objection, every question he has. He gives him Aaron to go with him, to speak for him. He promises to give him the words. And then God proceeds to demonstrate throughout the rest of Moses' life the change he can make when someone takes themselves off the throne and instead of being a slave to their nature, makes God their master. Let's go to the New Testament example. Paul was born in Tarsus, grew up in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel, who was one of the prominent teachers in Judaism at the time. He became a member of the strictest sect of the Jewish religion, known as the Pharisees. And he wasn't just there. He wasn't just a part of that. He tells us that he was zealous toward God. So much so that when he saw people doing things differently, when he heard about this Jesus who claimed to be the Messiah, he's angry about it. He's violent about it. He binds them, and he's persecuting that way unto death. We're introduced to him when he still goes there, when Stephen was stoned for reminding those first century Jews of all the times their people had rejected God with the simple statement that Saul consented to his death. He agreed with those who were throwing the stones. That's who Paul was. But God wasn't content with that. And so on that road to Damascus, after he had gone to the high priest and asked for letters so that he could go there and find any men or women who were of the way, bind them, take them back to Jerusalem to be tried and killed for heresy, God appears to him, intervenes in his life in that famous moment. And what does Paul say? What does Saul say? He says, "Oh Lord, what would you have me do?" And from that moment, after he meets with Ananias, he's baptized, the scales fall from his eyes. We read in verse 20 of chapter 9 of Acts that he immediately went and preached Christ in the synagogues, that he is the Son of God. This is such a dramatic change in his life that the other disciples don't believe it. They say, "Wait a minute, this is the one who was destroying those who called on the way." Verse 21. And in verse 26, when he came to them, they were all afraid of him and didn't believe that he was a disciple. That's the kind of dramatic change God made in his life. Now, there are those that may say, "Yeah, but that's who Paul was. He was zealous toward God, right, from the beginning. It's just he misunderstood and didn't really have a picture of who Jesus was. And once he saw that, he was just as zealous for Jesus as he was against him in the beginning. However, note that his actions changed. You see, before that moment, he's a very violent person. But after that moment, he's beaten with rods, he's stoned and left for dead, and he never fights back. He never raises a fist. He gets annoyed. He's still human, right? But from this point forward, who he is changed. And we go from seeing him as somebody who violently opposed anything but the strictest interpretation of the law as a Pharisee to someone who, in 1 Corinthians 9, tells us that he became all things to all men so that by all means he might save some. That's a drastic change. And we could go on. Many other examples. We could talk about Zacchaeus and how that he gave back anything that he had taken falsely, fourfold. We could talk about the man who was possessed by so many demons they called him Legion. And when Jesus threw all of those demons out of him, the people come and they find him sitting, clothed. And that shocks them so much. Just that he could sit still shocks them so much that they say, "Jesus, we need you to go. We're not comfortable being around this kind of power." That they recognized in the change that was made in that man's life. We could talk about the Philippian jailer, who instead of keeping Paul and Silas in that deepest, darkest dungeon, he goes to them and washes their wounds, takes them to his own home, feeds them, takes care of them. This is the kind of change that Jesus can affect in someone's life. And those are biblical examples. We can talk about modern ones. We can talk about the men who have set out to disprove the Bible. Once and for all, we're going to put this to bed. And when they really dig in and examine the evidence, they find out that, in fact, this is the truth that can set them free. Lee Strobel is one of the ones who's written a book called The Case for Christ, who set out to do that as an investigative journalist. He set out intending to put all of this to bed, to disprove it all. And everyone he talked to, all of the evidence he could find as an investigative journalist, someone who did this professionally, he became a believer because he couldn't find any evidence to the contrary. He couldn't find any logical explanation for the evidence except that the Bible is true. And there are others we could talk about, that individual, that example of somebody sitting in a jail cell who comes to the realization that they don't have to be a slave to sin. We could talk about examples of men and women who have struggled through addiction through the power of Jesus in their lives. Not some miraculous external thing, but simply by taking themselves and what they want off of the throne and making Jesus their master, doing what he wants them to do. They find themselves able, through his help, to struggle through that addiction. And example after example, time after time, we can talk about the change Jesus can make in our lives. But the point that I want to focus on this evening is that it's not just in those big, dramatic moments. It's not just when that person has hit them. It's not just when that prodigal son wakes up and comes to himself in the pig pen. He's so hungry he wants to eat the pig's food because he has none of his own. We're familiar with those moments, and we think in those moments, of course, you turn to God because you have nowhere else to turn. But it's not just in those moments. It's also in those little moments when we find ourselves tempted to give in to our nature, when it's easy just to do what comes natural, just to say that thing that might offend somebody. Maybe we think it's funny, maybe they don't. In those moments, we can stop and we can put Jesus on the throne. What would he do? What would he say? Does that make it easy? Tim talked this morning about the wise man who built his house on the rock and why that's so rare. Because it's hard. You have to dig. You have to work to build on the rock. It's easy just to look out there at that flat sand, right? Think, well, this is the greatest place. Just because it's possible doesn't make it easy. Just because it's simple doesn't make it easy, because we are fighting our nature. And it's not something that we're going to have success with every single day. But it's the kind of thing that we continually work toward. Rejecting our nature. And instead of being the way I am, trying to be the way he is. Because that is our goal. Not to be what I am, what I want to be, but what he is, what he would have me to be. Jesus said in chapter 12, "And if I am lifted up, I will draw all men to myself." And that's the part that we must play, is to lift him up. And how do we do that? We choose in those moments not to do what is natural, not what comes easy, but to do what he would do in those moments. To reach out to someone who might take offense. To apologize if necessary. And to be that helping hand. To show the love that Jesus showed to those that nobody wanted to be around when he was here. Reach out to share with them the love that Jesus has shared with us. This is not intended, I promise you, anytime I get up here, I'm speaking to myself as much as anyone else. Because this is a lesson I need to hear. Because it's so easy for me to think, well, that's just the way I am. I need to be better. I need to be the way He is. And I hope that I can encourage you to do the same. If there's something specific we can do for you, if we can pray for you, we'd love to pray with you. Most perfect. We don't stand in judgment on anyone. But we'd love to help you if we can. If you need our help, please come. We'll be happy to pray with you, pray for you, do anything we can for you. If you need tonight to put Him on the throne and to take yourself off, we'd love to help you with that. In whatever way, if there's anything we can do for you, please come as we stand and sing.